Welcome.
Hi, welcome back.
Welcome to Old Millennials, a deep dive on shallow topics from the late 90s and early 2000s. I am one of your hosts, Emily.
And I'm Margot.
Wow, we have a topic today that we love because it has been 20 fucking years since 1999. How insane.
I also saw a very accusatory meme today, and it was a picture of, like, one of those old Sony, like, cyber cam, like, digital cameras.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah,
like,
yeah.
If you went to the club with one of these, you need night cream. And I did go to the club with one of those. And that's so fucking rude.
Oh, man. And that was the time when so many different cameras were also being advertised. Like, I remember the iZone, which was, like, Polaroid sticky film camera.
I went to many a birthday party where it was, the theme was ostensibly iZone pictures of yourself.
We totally had one between my sister and I, and it was made many a vacation appearance.
And it's not like I was ever asking for quality from those instant cameras,
no.
But I remember it was especially dark. Like, you could never see anybody.
No.
Even on the brightest day at the sunniest fucking pool party, everybody was in the shade for some reason.
And it was just so small, so, like, you could see, yeah, just
well,
blur.
You're supposed to, like, stick them all over your binder and
yep.
stuff, but that's how you lose them. And then other people pick them up and put them in their locker, and that's creepy.
That is very creepy. I didn't know anyone who did that, but you did?
Apparently, yes. Well, yeah, people had done that around my school. I had noticed.
Wow.
I also did have a friend who found an old, like, wallet-sized school portrait of some dude that she had a crush on. She kept it. And I would remind her of that frequently. She's like, don't tell anybody. I'm like, I'm not going to. I'm just going to always keep pointing it out to you as weird.
I feel like that reminds
but
me.
But I never bullied her enough to toss it. She was just like, it's fine. He doesn't know. I'm like, that's my whole point, though, that he doesn't know.
That just reminds me, for whatever reason, of that episode in Pen 15 where they steal the thong from, like, one of the girls, because one of the girls in their class had a thong. And then they proceeded to wear it. Like, not quite as, like, I think that's even creepier, but, like.
That's also, not on the same level as Chad Brewster's 7th grade school photo, but.
No. And also much more sanitary than taking someone's.
Yeah, no. There was also once, like, a whole thing between, I forget which friend, and some football player. Or, like, she had his hat, and then they broke up, and she wouldn't give him back the hat. And then when she did give him back the hat, she gave him the burned hat or something. I can't really quite remember how it goes, but now we've gone on a whole tangent about stuff that happened in 99 and also not in 1999.
Which brings us back to that iconic year, which had so many iconic looks, movies, TV shows, and yes, songs. Oh, so many songs. And one, songs that kind of span different genres. I mean, it was a year where just about any type of genre or fusion of genres could get a hit song.
Well, this episode is mostly inspired by Rolling Stone's 99 songs of 1999, because as they so aptly point out in the beginning, this was when every single genre had not only a hit, but created some really long-lasting stars.
Yeah.
And it was a completely, like, fleeting moment for some people, like Len, which I have the pleasure of diving into. And these are, like, songs that we still can hear now that people love to sing at karaoke. They have that sort of, like, wistful, a time past quality to them. Yeah, even All Star by Smash Mouth is, like, kind of quaint right now for some reason. But I think that it's because it was sort of pre-Napster, mid-TRL, like, it was the peak time of Disney to mainstream pipeline with, like, Britney and Christina,
mm-hmm.
and even some of, like, the NSYNC guys. Lou Pearlman's Ponzi scheme, like, that was at its apex.
Oh, yeah.
Because NSYNC and Backstreet Boys were both charting, and they're both on this list, and we're not going to cover them because we have an entire episode dedicated to them, so you can just, like, go back and listen to the boy band yeah. episode. And conversely about Britney as well, we're not going to cover Baby One More Time, although technically, it is 98, but it blew up in 99,
yep.
and I believe the video came out in 99, and that was fucking huge. I mean, that's what made the song so successful, I believe.
Yeah.
Probably in addition to, like, the Rolling Stone cover and all the other things that happened to her in 99, but we're not covering that either, because we also have an entire Britney episode.
Yeah.
So, anyway, this was also probably the time in the 90s where, like, record labels just had so much fucking money.
So much money.
And I imagine, like, if Martin Scorsese didn't love the 70s so much, he should have made vinyl about the 90s, because I imagine it's just like Wall Street in the 80s with like just tons of coke and like a bunch of disposable income to like just take chances on literally whatever. Because there are also some bands on that list, some we'll talk about, some we won't, that honestly feel like they were created in a lab. Yep. Just to have a one-hit wonder,
right?
Just, similar to like a Ponzi scheme. It had a real Lou Pearlman-y touch to it.
I mean, and this is really one of those last years where any of those people sold at least a had a platinum record to their name.
This was also the
one song.
This was also the last, because this was the last time that people had to physically leave their home yep. and buy an entire yep. album in order to just listen to one song.
Yeah.
So that also has a huge impact on. Just, like, the numbers that some of these people did is crazy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
People that you will never hear from again, but hopefully make good royalty checks off of their songs being used in commercials and TV shows. Because there are some that definitely keep getting played, and you're like, whatever happened to...
Macy Gray?
Well, he's not on the list, but Lou Bega?
Oh, yeah.
Mambo number 5?
Yeah, I think that just missed the cut, because I think that was, like, 2000.
Yes. So, but also in addition to all, and we sort of just touched on it, but in addition to these songs being, like, hits and super catchy and everywhere at the time, especially in 99, they had music videos that yeah. are sort of iconic and stand out in your mind, and some of them have gone on to be sort of blueprints. Some are just made by the same three directors over and over again, and you can tell that it's Hype Williams, McGee, and who was the third?
Oh, there's, Spike Jonze.
Spike Jonze. No, who's the other McGee alike?
Spike Jonze, McGee, Hype Williams, Dave LaChapelle? No.
No, not really.
No, I'm forgetting the name.
But, well, just shout it out when it comes back to you.
Yes.
But to tie it all back to the Rolling Stone article, I would like to use a quote from Rob Sheffield's article, quoting the unproblematic king of the 90s, Mark McGrath. And he so thusly described 1999 as, you would hear Kiss FM or Z100 coming right up, Mariah Carey, Blink-182, Eminem, Sugar Ray. And you're like, what the fuck is happening? And he's completely right.
Yeah.
Those songs were all, everybody had hits. Yeah. Everybody was making money. Record labels were literally printing money. I felt like they had so many sub-labels that don't even exist anymore. Like, Arms of... Well, first of all, Jive doesn't exist anymore. No. But even, like, the sub-labels that had, like, big
like
names
the work
attached.
Group. The work group at Sony, like...
Oh, right.
There was... Epic was its own thing at that point. Like, you had all these, subsidiary labels. Like, under Interscope, you had so many different labels as well, like, sub-labels. It was a weird time, and like we've said in many episodes, so much A&R money was just being thrown everywhere. Oh, we found someone for this very specific niche genre. Let's go find two other people.
I feel
for
like they did so much market research
yep.
to create such yep. highly tailored bands. I mean, mm-hmm. it's sort of like now with streaming services
yes.
and their highly tailored content for audiences that, I mean, you have like niche.
Podcast networks,
even. Not even streaming anything
yeah.
online.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see. This was sort of the precursor to that, where it's over. 99 is an overload. It's almost an embarrassment of 90s riches because it's, I feel like, a culmination of an entire decade.
Yes.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
So we have picked 7 songs each, and then we have just some like honorable mentions that we'll tack on at the end that
yes.
we both really like. They were both on our short lists. I don't know if, like, we wanted to, like, do as much research about them versus... I think when it came down to it, we picked the ones that we really wanted. So we picked 7 songs
yeah.
that we both really liked and identified with. And we sort of split them into different categories, like one-hit wonders, just rap, R&B, like, standard categories.
Yep.
But I think we're going to kick it all off with one-hit wonders, if you would like to start.
Sure thing. Okay, so for my one-hit wonder pick, I picked I Try by Macy Gray. I went from loving this song to being annoyed by how overplayed it was, because it was really everywhere, in every TV show, every radio station, because it was, like, adult contemporary, but R&B, but pop, and, like, anyway.
And slow, and like,
slow, yeah.
And it was really inoffensive, and right. she has a nice voice,
she
so.
She does. And I went to, I came back to re-loving it again in the last 10 years, because my friend Luke... used to live in a group house with a bunch of guys who ranged in age from early 20s to early 40s. They all collectively loved to play this song at any given moment.
So was it? Would you say, because I also feel like in my group of friends, we'll just randomly play, like, Kiss from a Rose.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like a generational thing.
This was one, for whatever reason, this one song was I Try by Macy Gray, and they had it queued up in a CD player in their living room. There, once in a while, over beers, they would just be like, hey, you want to play Macy? Okay. And they would hit play button, and it would just, you could hear it everywhere. But more on to the facts of this song. The video is directed by Mark Romanek, who also directed the Johnny Cash Hurt music video, Closer by Nine Inch Nails, Can't Stop by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Scream by Michael and Janet Jackson, Criminal by Fiona Apple, and Shake It Off by Taylor Swift. What a career.
What a cap.
This guy also co-directed Sandcastles from Beyoncé's Lemonade album. He has won 20 MTV Music Video Awards and has won 3 Grammy Awards for Best Short Form Music Video. More than any other director.
Interesting.
This music video, we rewatched it together, and it was just like Macy Gray on a bunch of different forms of public transportation in New York, like Macy on the bus, Macy on the subway.
I feel like, isn't it cute that she's a working class girl? Yeah. I felt like that was a theme in music videos for a little while that was bizarre.
And the color palette of her outfit she's wearing, of course, this is also a big 90s thing, like long sleeves, but the jacket has shorter sleeves than the sweater.
Well, it was like having layers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like when you wear like a long sleeve shirt underneath your t-shirt.
Yep. Very, very big, visible layers. And it was like an orange, it's like a turquoise jacket, an orange sweater, and then she has pink Gerber daisies that she buys at the florist. It's just, yeah, just a really time capsule late 90s. I think I can re-listen to that song and really enjoy it, one, because of my friend Luke, but two, also just realizing, like, it's a great song, and yeah, I think I enjoyed it.
As you noted when we were watching this music video, the way that the music swells and there's like an exterior shot where you go up a high rise, you're like, this seems like someone's about to commit suicide.
It's a hotel. Like, it literally, the shot just like pans up quickly to the top.
And especially with the swell of violins. It was like an ominous string section moment. It was such an odd choice.
And something scary was about to happen. Or as you said, it's like a Hitchcock twist.
Yeah, like a vertigo, like she was gonna, be losing her balance or something in the middle of her hotel house room or wherever the fuck we are. Such a strange music video.
Yep.
Do you have any info on what Macy Gray is up to now? Do you have a where are they now?
Not for Macy Gray. I think she's kind of been releasing albums over the past few years. I remember that she did sing the theme song from that Nickelodeon cartoon show As Told by Ginger.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, and she also had a couple of, like, other songs that were in movies, but that was really her one big song. I think I remember she had a follow-up hit in the album after this one called Sweet Sweet Baby, and that's pretty much, that's Macy Gray. I mean, she's released other music, but it has not by any means caught on to the same level of success as I Try.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, my one-hit wonder is Steal My Sunshine by Len. A song I fucking loathe. I hate the song. I hate the song just as much as I hate that fucking Counting Crows cover where they're like, and put up a parking lot. Like, that song makes me want to throw myself off a bridge. No offense, that was insensitive. But it really does. It's like a song that really makes me want to curl up in a ball and scream. I fucking hate Steal My Sunshine. I hated it when it was out. It was everywhere. Yep. For whatever reason, people really latched onto it. And between the music video getting a ton of plays, which had a lot of, like, side swipes and, like, split screen, like the Brady Bunch, I fucking hated the song so much. So Len is basically a huge, they benefit greatly from a right place, right time, plus savvy PR. Because in my looking into Len, first of all, it was initially kind of difficult because they are not, a lot of their original work and blog posts and website stuff was all through MySpace, and so all those pages have been deleted since.
Yeah.
And so even their Wikipedia page is a little bit bare bones. There's not a ton to glean, and I mean, in their peak in 99, literally just that time, it wasn't like they did like a ton of interviews.
No.
They didn't really do much. All they did was release a follow-up album, which totally fucking bombed, and also goes into why I hate them, like, is nonsensical English. What? It's like Diaries of from the Madman. Like, what?
Wasn't the song on the Go soundtrack as well? I'm pretty sure this
Probably. The
song was on the Go soundtrack.
So what I have uncovered is that Len is actually a brother-sister duo named Mark and Sharon Costanzo, which these fucking nerds, I swear to God. they're also from Toronto, Canada, which made it all finally click for me. I was like, okay, this, like, weirdly annoying upbeat song. They're so fucking cheery. They're a little bit corny. I, like, get, like, a weird Flowers in the Attic vibe from this, I guess, now brother, sister. I totally thought they were fucking married up until literally today. I was today years old when I discovered that Len was a brother-sister duo and not, like, a husband-wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, or honestly, he was the I thought he was just the lead singer and she was just some fucking extra and that they, like, recorded her vocals, like, CNC Music Factory style, where it's just some random person, and then you have, like, a model as the front.
Right.
You know what I mean? Anyway, this goddamn fucking song was off their stupid album, Can't Stop the Bum Rush. And from the jump, it was difficult to discern who was even in this band, especially when you look at from the album art to the music video, because the music video is just them riding around on Vespas. And when I rewatched it today, I was like, is this Venice? And I don't think it is. I think it's like Virginia Beach or something.
It's Myrtle. I'm pretty sure it's Daytona Beach.
It's Daytona. It was in like Florida. It's some East Coast beach, but they're riding around on Vespas.
Yeah.
And as their day progresses, they accumulate more and more people. Like, there's some fucking Hare Krishna cult.
So I read that when they filmed this music video, they just had a budget and they blew through it by partying. Like, that the music video, if you watched it, was just, like, party central. Like,
okay, well, between the music video accumulating some random crowd, making it difficult to tell who the fuck is even in the Spanish with this white guy with a weird Kongle hat on, who vaguely looks like he's Fred Durst's cousin, Canadian cousin.
He really fucking does.
And their album art, which was just like, they looked like those cholo dolls that you used to get from the gumball machines.
Oh.
So they're animated in that way. So you're like, wait, so you didn't know if it was just like a random drawing, if this was a rendering based on the band.
Do you remember that clip art in the late 90s or early 2000s you put on a GeoCities page and it was like a sexy looking girl doll thing? Maybe
related. Where it had like a little bit of bling sparkle to it. Yeah, I feel you. And that's what their little album art looked like.
Right.
And so I feel like that was part of the reason why I found it difficult to connect or care about this band or this song. I mean, the song was so annoying and like everywhere all the fucking time, so that was a really difficult thing to also reconcile. But anyway, it would seem like the way that they marketed this, it would seem like the label's plan all along was to make this fucking one hit wonder, because they never really released any other supporting singles from this album. And the way that the song is structured, it really feels like the lyrics are obviously second to whatever is happening in the beat, which feels like it was just designed to stick in your ears and just always be stuck in your head all of the time. Another thing that they did to try and capitalize on the popularity of the time was that there were a lot of, like, rap rock DJ groups, and so they added three quote-unquote members to Len. DJ Moves, D-Rock, which is obviously a fucking Beastie Boys ripoff, and Planet P, but it's completely unclear what they brought to the group, if anything. My main gripe is with the lyrics, which are aggressively nonsensical, to the point where I felt like, yes, this must be an experiment. They must have been created in a lab that makes bands that just want to piss you off and play an annoying, shitty song that's just here to make money. So some of their lyrics... I know it's up for me. That's not a complete thought. What does that even fucking mean? Followed up by, don't steal my sunshine. That doesn't mean anything.
No.
Not at all. I will admit that the spelling later out was good, but my sticky paws were into making straws out of big fat slurpy treats. What the fuck is that? And why is that a viable lyric in a song? And then why did everybody sing this for so many years afterwards?
Oh, God.
An incredible 8-foot heap, now the funny glare to pay a gleaming tart in a streaming, or, oh my God. It's fucking rhymezone.com gone fucking crazy. I'm not reading any more of this bullshit lyrics. I hate this fucking band. Just know that it's not a song that makes much sense, and their chorus of I missed a million miles of fun. I don't know what the fun was, where it was, how they missed it. It's all unclear because
also,
fuck this fucking
Canada
song.
Canada uses the metric system, so shouldn't it be a million
kilometers of fun? You're right. You're totally right. Here are some facts. Can't Stop the Bum Rush peaked at 46 on the Billboard chart and went gold. 50,000 physical fucking copies sold because you had to listen to this one song by buying this entire stupid album. And that's what they wanted all along. This is my... This is my Kennedy conspiracy theory.
Oh, my God.
All of those copies are probably now floating around in some fucking second and third hand shops for a few bucks. Mark was the lead singer, or I'm sorry, let me take that back. Mark was the guitarist in Sum 41 when he wrote Steal My Sunshine.
What? So
fuck Sum 41.
What?
Yes. And here is the whole Broken Social Scene connection that we were sort of talking about earlier. Brendan Canning from Broken Social Scene was briefly in the band, and I believe... Yep. From what I've pieced together is that he is also partly responsible for this song. He and Mark were at some 3-day rave together where Brendan was DJing and he played the disco song More, More, More at some point during this godforsaken 3-day rave. And Mark was so into the piano break that he sampled it, and that's how we have Steal My Fucking Sunshine. Fuck you, Broken Social Scene, you fucking dicks. Jesus Christ. Yeah, that's my one-hit wonder.
That's your one-hit wonder. Well, now we're going to move into hip-hop, which I had, I covered Vibrant Thing by Q-Tip, which I love this song. It will still get me on a dance floor to this day. It's from Q-Tip's debut solo album, which was called Amplified. And of course, Hype Williams directed this music video, which is where, this is where we start in our Hype Williams territory.
Oh, yes, because the next song is, the music video is also directed by Hype Williams.
We, in our quest to get you descriptions and information on all the songs that we're covering today, found out that Hype Williams probably directed, I think, a solid third of the songs we're talking about today.
That sounds about right, but I'm not great at math.
I'm not either, but it's of course, all the, like, Hype Williams signatures. So when you have the camera up front and someone is, like, going in, it's, like, a close-up where it kind of looks like the fisheye lens, but it's, like, a camera cheat.
Oh, when someone is pulling focus.
Right.
Rack focus.
So that's a huge part of Hype Williams. There's always, like, the background with, like, light bulbs or a weird tunnel. The interesting thing about this music video, though, is it's in black and white, which I can't think of any other Hype Williams music videos that are in black and white. I think the rest of them are color, for sure.
I think you're right, because I was like, ooh, Belly. Nope, that's no. All blue.
Yeah, it's all blue. Yeah, this is, I mean, and those are like, there's like the 3-year period where it's like peak Hype Williams. It's like, because Belly comes out in 98, I think, or maybe it is 99. I don't remember.
It's around there. I don't remember either.
But this is also around the time that I found this out during my research. Q-Tip was a member of the Pussy Posse, which we've talked about briefly in a few episodes. Again, the people that are included in this group of friends are, of course, Leonardo DiCaprio as the leader, Tobey Maguire.
As the leader?
I mean, if one, that word is used so loosely in this term, in this scheme, Tobey Maguire, Lucas Haas, Harmony Korine, Kevin Connolly, and magician David Blaine, who I get to talk about later, when he dated
with some really tragic facial hair in that picture that you showed me.
Oh God, like a pirate, but like a late '90s coked out pirate. This song was also iconically used in a couple of MTV shows for sure. I'm pretty sure I remember it showing up in Daria and like a couple of other shows where they and like MTV Undressed. It was also in the show Pen 15 recently. When the school dance episode, the song was produced and the album was actually produced by J Dilla.
Cool.
R.I.P. They're both the song and the music video and the album itself are a big departure for Q-Tip, because I remember, like, of course, Q-Tip, as you all know, was in a Tribe Called Quest, and the sound and the look for Tribe Called Quest was very different from this Hype Williams directed music video where they're like scantily clad women and like fancy cars, and it's just like a very different vibe from like what Tribe Called Quest pretty much did. But you can definitely hear, if you're listening to like the Love Movement, which was Tribe's last album before their initial breakup, they got back together like 15 years later after Fife Dog died to release an album.
R.I.P.
The Love Movement definitely has like some songs that kind of feed into that, like Stressed Out has Faith Evans. Like, it just, there's a lot more of an R&B kind of vibe that's more alongside what you heard more mainstream music sounding like. The other thing that comes to mind here, fun fact, was the fourth rap song to reach number one on the Billboard Hot R&B Airplay chart since its 1992 inception.
Huh.
Yeah, it's very specific. I feel like Billboard has since consolidated a lot
Billboard's
of their charts.
Billboard's so different. So I have some Billboard chart stuff too, but I tried to keep it just to the Hot 100 because a lot of them like peaked on different ones.
Right.
But the one that still remains now, because I don't know... I mean, even with streaming, too, it gets really in the minutiae of streaming and, like, record sales and listens and stuff. But, yeah, I don't know what that means, but it sounds impressive.
Yeah. So that's what I have to say about Vibrant Thing. I was hoping for more facts, but I actually didn't find as much as I had hoped for.
Q-Tip's a little private.
He is for sure. I also didn't realize, I forget, like, he's 49, which is so crazy to me. Yeah. A lot of these artists, like, you're about to talk about Jay-Z, and he's 48, 49 as well, right?
Or older,
yeah.
I wouldn't doubt.
Yeah.
But yes, Mr. Knowles, Mr. Beyonce Knowles. I'm here to talk about Big Pimpin' today. Excuse me. A legitimate hip-hop classic turned Jay-Z's personal You Gotta Fight for Your Right to Party, because it's a song that took his career to the next level, but in retrospect, he regrets the lyrics. I don't know if he's stopped performing it since he came out and said that. He said that around 2010, which is around the time that I saw him, and he did play that song. But I could see why he would stop playing it. He has other hits, but he definitely has come out and talked about how he regrets the lyrics of the song.
I don't think he played it. I saw him on the Run Tour with Beyonce, the first one, like 5 years ago, and I don't remember him playing it.
I mean, I'm sure he has, yeah, like, a different set list when he tours with,
for sure,
Beyonce, but I don't know. It was at Coachella. That's the last time I saw him, and that's when he played it. So, any hoodle, this song is one of those special songs that is a universal bop where people, as soon as you put it on at a party, everybody will start dancing, or at the very least will at least start, like, moving along to it. It's just so catchy, and that catchiness is really attributed to the Egyptian flute that is looped in the background that frames the entire song that was created by Timbaland and Jay-Z. But this is also the notorious flute loop. That's not easy to say. Flute loop that had the song embroiled in a years-long lawsuit with the original creator. So Jay-Z initially had found this song on some random Bollywood compilation, or belly dance, excuse me, compilation.
Yeah.
And so they used the flute, they looped it, and then years later, the people who were in charge of the estate of the original artist who created the flute sample for them came and, like, sued them, and then countersued them several times. Finally, in 2018, they settled and they ruled in Jay-Z's favor. So I think they got nothing, and it was sort of like a frivolous lawsuit. But without the flute, it would be a completely different song.
For sure. They actually feature the original song in the Hulu TV show Rami, which is about a guy whose family is Egyptian. He's American.
Oh, but interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the song also features UGK, which is like a Houston-based rap group featuring Bun B and Pimp C, which I didn't mean to rhyme those two. But I bring up Pimp C only because Pimp C hated this fucking track. He did not like the beat at all, so much so that he didn't come to the taping of the music video. He's not in the video at all, but his bar is probably everybody's favorite part of the rap. So, and also, speaking of the music video, another iconic piece of pop culture, something that is the blueprint for a lot of opulent, like, rap music videos.
Yeah.
It's the direct inspiration for Lonely Island's I'm on a Boat.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And this music video for Big Pimpin' was directed by Hype Williams, and it features Jay-Z and the members of UGK minus Pimp C, but plus a Too Short in the background in some of the shots. They're on a yacht with a bunch of, like, hot bitches on their way to Trinidad to go to Carnival, and it's just them partying and smoking cigars, and it's Jay-Z in a fucking bucket hat, like, dancing on, like, the roof of, like, this dope-ass yacht, like, a nicer yacht than the one that's on Below Deck Med / Below Deck Regular of Bravo. And it just looked like a party that everybody wanted to be a part of, and I really do think this is a song that was already very catchy and that people really wanted to, like, to begin with, because it was, I wouldn't say the beginning of Jay-Z's career, I think it's, like, sort of the middle beginning of it.
Yeah.
But it's one of his more mainstream songs that sort of took off, and I feel like the music video really sort of supported, like, the fantasy that the song paints in a very perfect word picture. And on the stat side, this is the third single, weirdly enough, off of the Volume 3 Life and Times of S. Carter, and it's the most successful one. It peaked at number 18 on the Billboard Hot 100, but it also, like, topped a bunch of other niche charts in relation to, like, rap and hip-hop. It is also on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs of All Time, as it rightly should be. Mm-hmm. It's obviously, like, a karaoke staple. Mm-hmm. You hear the shit all the time. It constantly still gets played. It really holds up. I really love Big Pimpin'. I can listen to it all the time. It never gets old for me.
It's a great song.
Peak Jay-Z. I don't have any other interesting facts. I just thought, the thing that I didn't really realize or hadn't heard yet was that Jay-Z regrets the song.
Yeah.
Not to bring it up one last time, but I had no idea. I thought that he would be happy with a song that was probably fairly successful for him.
It's funny that he regrets it, but it's one of those songs that put him in the mainstream map. Like, definitely people knew him before because of Hard Knock Life and, like, Bounce With Me and, like, others, or Can I Get a What? Like, people knew him for other songs, but that was one of the ones that I feel like really put him on the map, and like put things like Pimpin' and Big Pimpin' and like the lexicon culturally for old white people.
Or just for white people.
For white people.
Full stop. Yeah. I think this song has like just incredible lasting power, even though the lyrics are problematic. I think it just is one of those songs that gets a pass.
Yeah. To go to a completely different direction from here.
An aggressive swerve.
We are going into our kind of feminist idols, indie singers that we both picked.
Indie rock queens.
Yeah, indie rock queens. Mine was Paper Bag by Fiona Apple. We are both huge Fiona Apple fans. This song is the second single from When the Pawn. I'm not going to read the whole album title.
Jesus Christ, no, it's fine.
But it does hold the record in Guinness Book of World Records for the longest album title ever.
Oh, that's funny.
Way to go, Fiona.
Because when people are like, oh, like, what's your favorite kind of poetry? And I was like, Fiona Album's album. Fiona Apple's album, When the Pawn, and all the other words that follow that make it a poem.
It's not Jewel's book of poetry.
I also have that book as well, and I do like some of her poems.
A Knight Without Armor.
But to be fair, I'm an idiot, and I also don't really like poetry that much.
So this was the second single after Fast As You Can, but before Limp. This was my gateway into Fiona Apple. Like, I had known the album title, but didn't really know it that well, just because I was, like, at probably 8 or 9 when it was released.
Oh, really? You didn't ever get into Criminal
later. I did, but, like, it was, my gateway was actually the one, When the Pawn album.
I have to say, a quick detour, my Fiona Apple in was, before I even heard any of her music, I saw her acceptance speech, at the 99 VMAs.
Or it was, like, 97, probably, because that's from Tidal. It was, like,
Or 98, because, like, they always do them, like, the year after you're recorded. But either way, when I saw her in that, I, like, circled back around and got into Criminal, even though it was, like, way too old and mature for me. I was not ready for that. But that was, like, one of the first albums that I bought.
Oh, yeah?
Like, that and, like, Weezer's Blue album.
I definitely, yeah, I bought those maybe, like, 2 years later. But I bought When the Pawn. It was, for me, what stands out is in a sea of, like, this was people hitting all crazy high notes and like singing as like belty as you can. Fiona has a really low alto voice, and it was the first time I'd heard that on the radio, really, or memorably can think of that.
Right, because you had like peak Whitney Houston, yes, you had Christina Aguilera, you had Mariah, so it was a lot of belters.
Right.
And she was literally and figuratively the alternative.
Very like smoky low alto voice.
Yes.
She is someone I adore and absolutely idolize singing wise. I fell in love with this album. I later bought Tidal, and that's when it was like game over for me. Just became like the biggest fan. The music video was directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. This is right around when Boogie Nights came out.
Future ex-boyfriend Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, they were dating at the time when he filmed this. The music video for me is really cool. Like it's interesting. It's like Fiona Apple dressed in like 40s garb, and then a bunch of little boys wearing like 1940s-ish suits.
I feel like you described it perfectly. Oh, like they casted all of the kids that were currently on Broadway.
Pretty much. That's how I felt. Like, I just remember, I looked this up. Newsies, the movie came out in like 92, and then Newsies, the musical came out in like 2014. It was like during this 25-year gap, they needed to cast a bunch of 10-year-old boys somewhere, and thank God for Paul Thomas Anderson and Fiona Apple, because they cast them all in this movie. They all did these great dance routines. The other thing is that she wrote Paper Bag following an experience, this is from Wikipedia, in which she mistook a plastic bag for a dove, which is literally a plot point in the movie American Beauty, and is also featured in the song Firework, Katy Perry. Do you ever feel like a plastic bag drifting through the wind? Anyway, I don't remember those lyrics.
I'm not as familiar with Firework, except for what James Franco says in that Seth Rogen
the
movie.
Interview with Kim Jong. What a time. Anyway, so...
But that's hilarious, and I had no idea that was the backstory.
I didn't either, but apparently, her dad was driving her in a car in L.A. somewhere, and she saw this. I thought it was a bird, but it was just a paper bag, as the lyrics state. That's what I kind of have to say about Paper Bag. The other thing that I really love are the really lush horn arrangements in this song. I think it's a really beautiful song. It's definitely, like, Fiona will sometimes show up with a jazzy song, especially with her vocals here and there, but, like, this is really one for me that stands out. And it's kind of funny because it was released shortly after Pleasantville came out, which she had two songs on that soundtrack, the cover of Across the Universe by the Beatles, and also another, like, she sings a cover of a standard called Please Send Me Someone to Love, which is like an old song, but very similar arrangements, very lush and horn heavy.
And also just the theme of the music video seemed to borrow heavily from Pleasantville in a weird way.
Yeah.
I would also say if you are a Fiona Apple fan, you should listen to her interview with Marc Maron because it's really good. That's probably one of my favorite interviews of hers. My feminist icon, pop punk legend, Kathleen Hanna. This is Hot Topic by La Tigra. Mm. Kathleen Hanna formed La Tigra after Bikini Kill ended with Reject All American with her former roommates. Well, one of them, Kathleen used to live with Joanna Fateman, but they were both her former bandmates with Sadie Benning when they were in Troublemaker. Joanna Fateman is a zine writer and Sadie Benning is a filmmaker. She also directed a music video for Kathleen Hanna's solo side project, Julie Ruin, which is now a full-fledged band, but you can trace it back to 1997 when she had first started as she had envisioned it as a solo project. And they initially, the three of them came together because they were going to be sort of like background supporting vocals for Julie Ruin, but then they just had so much fun playing together, they formed La Tigra. Sorry, were you going to say something?
Oh, this is before J.D. Samson was in the band, right?
Yes. Sadie will eventually leave after their debut album comes out, their self-titled comes out, and then she'll be replaced with J.D. Samson, who had started as a roadie for them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yep. Which is really fun.
And then J.D. Samson went on to do Men with Joanna Fateman, I'm pretty sure, too.
Yes, and someone else.
I don't remember who. I just remember reading... There's
Is it Beth Dito from The Gossip?
Maybe. I'd have to look that up. That was a great show, by the way. I saw The Gossip years ago.
I've heard nothing but good things about Beth Dito as a lead singer, especially for The Gossip, or even just for her... She had, like, a solo tour a couple years ago.
I met her because it was really early on in their career, and she was so, so sweet, and I think she signed something my friend and I had. Yeah.
See? What a class act.
Yeah.
I think, again, to reference the inspiration for this episode, Rob Sheffield, I believe he put Hot Topic best where he called it a Riot Girl summer party, because that's really what it felt like. Even though it's not, the song Hot Topic is not as popular as the other songs, as well, just honestly, Decepticon, which completely took off and had been remixed to the ends of the earth by more popular bands and traded among DJs, and that's kind of initially how I came to La Tigra was... at, like, an indie club, and it was a remix of Decepticon, because I'd always been a Bikini Kill fan, but I didn't know about La Tigra until later, which I never understood how that happened to me, but whatever. Anyway, obviously the most iconic part of Hot Topic is them doing the roll call of, like, progressive feminist activists like Gertrude Stein,
Angela Davis,
Billie Jean King, Ann Peebles. La Tigra completely falls in line, and especially Hot Topic with Kathleen Hanna's themes of being political in her art and in her message, but this was the first time that we heard kind of a more upbeat, pop-punk, new wave kind of sound from her, because before it was all just Bikini Kill, and that was all just, like, really hardcore punk rock.
I love the connection, because, so Ann Peebles wrote the song I Can't Stand the Rain and sang that, and that later, our girl Missy samples it in The Rain Super Duper Fly, so I just had to bring that up.
And Missy's Hot Boys remix is on our honorable mentions shortlist. But yeah, there's not really much else to say about La Tigra and Hot Topic. Their album, La Tigra, it was really critically received very well. And I think people really love Decepticon and they love this album. And This Island comes after it, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really popular album as well. And they went on to do good stuff and then they all split up. And Kathleen went on to do more Julie Ruin stuff. J.D. Samson and Joanna Fateman went and did Men. And then just this year, Bikini Kill reunited. And I got to see them. And that was amazing.
And I am forever jealous.
All right, who is your pop punk? Well, that's not pop punk. I would just say, like, poppy band
rock
thing.
Yeah.
Pop rock?
Yeah, I would say that.
That was a long way to get to that one.
I did Why Don't You Get a Job by The Offspring.
Oh, man, the laughs I had watching that music video.
We enjoyed it thoroughly. So this is off their album Americana, which was such a huge hit. It included Pretty Fly for a White Guy and The Kids Aren't All Right. I was never a diehard Offspring fan, full disclosure, but I know every word to this song because it is a karaoke gem.
I can co-sign that because she was singing along to the fucking music video.
It's basically obla-di, obla-da for our generation. And look, and here is down to the fact that they pointed this out in the Wikipedia article and very other, like, other people have wrote articles about this song. It has the same chord progression. It follows the same chorus.
No, it's, like, essentially a cover or a parody.
Of it, yes. I mean, I won't pay, I'll pay, obla-di, obla-da. Like, anyway, I won't go into singing all of this, but it is...
If you know, you know, and you know, all probably know.
You probably all know. So while I researched this song, I found out the music video was, of course, directed by McG, because on this list, if not directed by Hype Williams, there is a 65% chance it was directed by McG.
You're just, like, making up these numbers now.
Guys, I am a statistician. Do not...
Do not come for me in my mentions about my stats.
You know how some people are armchair psychologists? I'm an armchair statistician, and I will...
That's not a thing.
It is now.
Yeah, I guess if you just, like, put it on a business card, everyone's forced to recognize that as a thing you're doing.
I'm looking at moo.com right now for discounts.
Oh, goodness gracious. Okay, so you take your certified stats with you.
Yep, this has been, so obviously McG, big director, and a lot of the songs we're going to cover today, almost all our music videos with McG have this very, like, iconic themes of, like, very, to put it best, because The Offspring's album was called Americana, a lot of Americana tie into it, very kitsch. Campy,
super, 50s, super campy.
60s, like, you have a lot of babes in these music videos that are dressed.
It does feel like really heavily Hairspray inspired, yeah, in some ways.
Yeah, like
you
John
know?
Waters.
But super exaggerated, big bouffants, like women in like leopard print, yeah, pieces with like big, yeah, beehives, like, and like really icon. Well.
Rockabilly, like...
Well, there was that time in 99 where it was... Rockabilly made some sort of weird comeback.
Rockabilly swing thanks to Gap commercials.
And thanks to Brian Setzer Orchestra.
Yeah, the Zoot Suit Riot, the Cherry Poppin' Daddies.
Cherry fucking Poppin' Daddies, Jesus Christ.
God, what else? There is...
Voodoo Glow Skulls.
My
favorite story to tell is when my friends and I went and saw Social D, but Voodoo Glow Skulls was opening for them. And there are a bunch of greasers and my friend's brother, and we were, like, walking through the crowd to try and find a good spot. Like, six greasers walk by him, and he looks at us, and he turns around, he's like, "Hey, Sandy!" at them as they walk by. We're like, oh my god, we're gonna get our fucking asses kicked here.
Tying this back, in those McG videos, even the band members are wearing kind of, like, rockabilly-type shirts. Like, a lot of the band
members... All of them are wearing fucking Charlie Sheen bowling shirts.
Exactly. And so in this music video, the setting for it is actually it's called Colonial Street, and it was a set that was used as Wisteria Lane in Desperate Housewives and the Courthouse Square that is used in the Back to the Future trilogy. So in certain points, you'll see a clock tower in the back, and that is the clock tower from Back to the Future. The music video also features one of the Pussycat Dolls, not Nicole Scherzinger. I forget her name, but she is, like, the girl at the end when they're like, my friend's got a girlfriend or boyfriend, and she hates that dick. She's the girlfriend.
The one that, like, rips off her robe and her hair and bonnet and becomes, like, a sexy American flag or something.
While making her deadbeat boyfriend throw up. Like, it was
weird. He also poured mustard on himself.
And on his
the whole point, direction, yeah, of that McG was questionable.
Very questionable. The also other people who make appearances, Bob Eubanks from the Newlyweds game from the 70s. He's a game show host. And the actor who was in the Pretty Fly for a White Guy music video makes an appearance at the end. Anyway, this
What's that guy doing? You think he wrote his college essay about how he was the pretty fly for a white guy kid?
And when he went to the tattoo parlor and he asked for a 14, but they drew a 49.
Please stop.
I'll stop. Anyway, the song still is fun to sing at a karaoke bar. I don't think I'd go and listen to it all the time, but I will definitely, next time I go out for karaoke and have a few drinks in me, will jam out to this.
I hope we don't.
You won't be there.
I will RSVP no.
This is a Facebook event. Go see Emily perform. Why don't you get a job by The Offspring?
I'm going to RSVP no. My pop rock song is Every Morning by Sugar Ray.
Because
who would have thought the band to age the best in the last 20 years would be Sugar Ray? Obviously, that's very debatable. But I feel like, for whatever reason, Mark McGrath remains an unproblematic prince in all of our... He's like the Keanu of shitty late 90s, early 2000s.
I'm so worried that you, because you put that out there, tomorrow the New York Times is going to bring a story on, like, some garbage, how much of a garbage human Mark McGraw is.
God, please don't do that. I want him to remain pristine in my mind. But along with Everclear, so much for the afterglow, I will defend Sugar Ray's 1459, which is a really great title. They were so in on the joke. And I think that them being in on the joke, them honestly looking like they were having the best time, like they knew at any moment this was all going to get taken away, but they were having a great time regardless, is why they're just fun. It's just stupid fun. And this song is still super fucking catchy. I Will Die on the Hill That Every Morning is a good song.
It is.
It's not a guilty pleasure. It's a good song. It still holds up. There's nothing wrong with it. It's like a good lazy song to have in the background. It's a good roller rink song that you wouldn't mind hearing, which is a wonderful segue because their whole music video, first of all, is directed by McG.
Of course.
But second of all, it takes place in a roller rink. And for whatever reason, watching the music video back reminded me of another quote from Rob Sheffield describing how Sugar Ray, when they were on the cover of Rolling Stone, they showed up for the shoot, and Mark was super hungover, and his PR handler person kept trying to convince him to keep his shirt on, but he didn't keep his shirt on, because he was just partying all the time, as he should have, because it was never going to last forever.
He knew.
And so I'm glad that Sugar Ray made money, and I'm glad they were able to capitalize on their 1459 of fame, and that Mark McGrath doesn't need to unfrost his tips anymore, because frosted tips have come all the way back around in 20 years.
Mark McGrath did really well for himself after Sugar Ray. I think they're still a band.
Well, he was like an E-correspondent, and didn't Sugar Ray, like, go on some county fair tour, reunion tour?
Not to mention, when Celebrity Jeopardy was still a thing, or Rock and Roll Jeopardy on VH1, he won all the goddamn time. It was always Mark McGrath that won. So
that's so wild.
He could be on this podcast and he would shell out some good pop culture knowledge, I'm sure.
I am sure of it, because he also was always game for those VH1, Remember the 90s, and he was always really funny and personable. Like I said, was just a second ago, he was like an E! Or Access Hollywood correspondent for a long time. Right. He's sort of like Carson Daly, where you're like, good for you, Mark McGrath.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
And good for Sugar Ray. As you so rightfully pointed out, he comes out in the Every Morning music video at the end with a French flag guitar, because the American flag colors are all fucked up. Beyond this just being a good song, of which I will constantly defend, this was also their most successful single. It was number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100, which is crazy. And it was the country's second best-selling single that year.
What?
I know. I don't know what number 1 was, because I was so caught off guard by it being number 2.
God.
But I was like, holy shit, what? And that's all I got for Sugar Ray's Every Morning. All
right.
When I wake up, there's a halo
hanging from my girlfriend's four-post bed.
All right.
So now we go into grab bag, I guess. Well, we both picked songs for our number 5s are very different songs.
I would say personal pick.
Personal pick. Mine was Praise You by Fatboy Slim. I picked this song for a couple reasons. One, the iconic music video needs to be talked about. Spike Jonze directed it, and Spike Jonze, to remind you of what he's directed outside of his movies, the Buddy Holly music video. I think he did a couple of other Weezer ones.
Sabotage,
yes. Beastie Boys. I'm blanking right now. I'm sure I'll remember one later and I'll shout it out. But Spike Jonze directed this iconic guerrilla-style music video that was shot on a personal camcorder.
It was honestly, truly performance art.
And Roman Coppola also co-directed it. So I think this is before he and Sofia Coppola broke up. Or maybe they remained friends.
What?
Roman Coppola.
Her brother?
Yes.
But Sofia Coppola and Roman Coppola could never have dated because they're brother and
sister. No, what I'm saying is that Sofia Coppola and Spike Jonze were together.
Oh, I see what you mean.
And Roman Coppola, I think,
yes, this is before the whole Cameron Diaz thing.
Yes. Yes.
In Lost in Translation.
Yes.
I follow you now, but the way that you worded it initially, I was very confused.
Apologize. To confirm, Sofia Coppola and Spike Jonze dated.
To go back over your order, this is what happened.
Sofia Coppola and Spike Jonze dated. Spike Jonze co-directed this music video with Roman Coppola. And then later, Sofia Coppola and Spike Jonze broke up because he cheated on her with Cameron Diaz, which you can see in the movie Lost in Translation, in which the Cameron Diaz character is played by Anna Faris.
And Roman Coppola and Spike Jonze haven't worked together since.
I do not think so.
Okay.
I would hope not. So this gem is amazing. It's shot guerrilla style with like a personal camcorder at a movie theater in Westwood. As Margo and I were rewatching this music video, we noticed two movies were playing at the time, Practical Magic and Pleasantville.
People were in line while they were watching this performance art dance piece happen, and they were going to go watch Practical Magic.
The fictional dance troupe featured in this music video is the Torrance Community Dance Group. The dance routine is led by their leader, who is actually Spike Jonze in a iconic glass tight polo shirt jean combo, which the glasses he is wearing have croquis or glass holders, whatever you want to call them. The music, the dance is, of course, ridiculous and wonderful at the same time. I myself can probably do about 40% of that routine by heart.
More stats. And more unfounded stats. I'm gonna need links to all of these numbers, Em.
God, I'm gonna spend tonight doing all the math. In a world where Beyonce dance routines are what people want to learn during their workout classes, as I once tweeted, where is the Praise You dance class? Why can't I sign up for that at my local gym? Can you please talk to your friends who own a dance studio?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you mean you want me to talk to Hipline?
In a Hipline, yes.
About possibly doing a Praise You dance series? Okay,
it's a good
workout. I will talk to Samar. I will ask her.
I'll
have to probably show her this music video because I'm sure she will not know what I'm talking about.
No. The other final thing I want to point out of this song, other than it's featured in the movie Cruel Intentions, which a couple of the songs on this list were as well, and the guitar riff at the beginning. So Fatboy Slim samples a bunch of different songs in this, but the one that I want to point out, the guitar riff, is from a record that Disney released in the 70s called Mickey Mouse Disco. They released, to capitalize on the disco trend in the 70s, Disney released disco record, and they were all disco covers of their famous Disney classics, and is the guitar riff from the disco version of It's a Small World After All.
Wow.
Which you can hear on Spotify.
Oh, that's a whole lot of information to process.
Yes.
I also just love this entire fake dance troupe's outfit scheme. It's all 80s tearaway pants and oversized shirts, and as you said, I want to Where Are They Now of everyone in this dance troupe. I think the old gentleman is probably no longer with us.
There's a lot of age diversity in this crew, and I appreciate Spike Jonze took the time to cast that way.
I forgot how funny that music video really was and how ahead of its time it was. It is so fucking funny.
Yeah.
And Spike Jonze is just so weird. So strange. What a strange little man.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my pick features, I guess Jonathan Davis is kind of a strange little man in his own right.
Kilt wearing man.
Freak on a Leash by Korn. This is new metal genre. At least I put it in there, but you could say it's a grab bag. Their music video was not shot guerrilla style. I'll tell you that much. I have a lot of personal effect. There are a couple bands on here. I think the next one is probably like a personal affection band too, but I have a lot of affection for Korn. I really loved them in middle school. I don't know why I was so mad, but they, for whatever reason, were the soundtrack to my middle school angst. Freak on a Leash in particular, I have some like funny memories associated with them. So under the banner personal pits, I'm going to rattle off a few. My husband refers to this music video as the one where Jonathan Davis yells at a bullet. Which is very, I mean, there are no lies detected in review of Freak on a Leash. My best friend, who is also a Korn super fan, so much so that in our 8th grade graduation pictures, she iconically wore a Korn shirt. She likes to trot that out every once in a while and post
beautiful.
It. It's so fucking funny. She, this year, went on a mission, which no one asked her to go on. She wanted to have the response meme to Justin Timberlake's meme of, it's gonna be May, you know, that everybody posts on May 1st.
Yeah.
Or or April 30th or whatever. She wanted to have the definitive end of May going into June meme where it was Jonathan Davis. where it's Jonathan Davis saying fall. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry to out you this way, Marianne. Where it's Jonathan Davis saying falling away from May. She really, 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 really wanted that to be the definitive response meme to the Justin Timberlake, it's gonna be May. And honestly, she's onto something because this music video spent 10 consecutive days at number one on TRL, and it was like a fuck you to NSYNC fans. So maybe she's onto something. She's onto something, that's all I'm saying.
What music video did it take down?
I forget. I don't know. I didn't look that up, but that's like one of its claims to fame. And also, the same best friend, she and I, for the longest time, were convinced that in the scatting portion, Jonathan Davis says dog email. Dog email. We were like, yeah, definitely. He's scatting. We're like, what's a scat if you don't say something weird like dog email?
I played Guitar Hero one time with a friend of mine who he has since passed away, unfortunately. But we were playing Guitar Hero about 10 years ago, and we were doing Freak on a Leash, and I proceeded to try to do the scat part. He's like, no, 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 and proceeds to do it perfectly, like, with the right intonation and everything. And I was in awe. So that was something that I treasure as one of the memories I shared with him. Sorry to bring it down.
Oh, no, it's fine. Freak on a Leash was an angsty 12-year-olds rise up. This was our call to arms.
Yeah.
And so if this song hit you at the right time, you would know things like that. Like how to correctly scat along with Jonathan Davis.
Incredible.
This band and this song in particular, I hold personally responsible for things like Hot Topic, so we all are on the same page. This is the second single off of Follow the Leader and is one of Korn's more successful singles. It reached 89 on the Billboard Hot 100 and was even more popular for whatever reason in Australia, going gold there. The music video definitely aided its popularity. It was directed and animated by Todd McFarlane, who is best known for drawing issues of Spider-Man and Spawn, and drew the opening where the kids are playing hopscotch at the edge of a cliff and then a cop comes out and accidentally shoots somebody almost. And also, that was based off of their cover art. And so it should be noted that the album did come out in late 1998. And this music video came out in February of 99. So this was all pre-Columbine. Because I believe after that happened, they had alternate album art that wasn't as, like, violent or ominous, kind of the way that, at least from what I remember, this being a big deal. When the Distillers released Coral Fang, they had, like, someone being crucified on their album art cover, and so they had an alternate one made because some record stores wouldn't carry it, which I'm assuming is, like, The Warehouse and, like, Sam Goody and stuff.
And, like, Walmart, for sure.
Yeah, because you could definitely find it at, like, indie record stores. You could buy, like, the original album art, but you couldn't, shout out to Penny Lane in Burbank.
Right.
But you couldn't get it at, like, a warehouse, as I said, or FYE. The song has been re-released 10 times in the UK, but was re-released only once in the US in 99 after radio stations started to refuse to play it because they had a noisy, crunchy guitar break that went on for a long time, and it just, like, wasn't sitting well with people, and so they pulled their fans. They're like, oh, would you guys like the song more if it didn't have this noisy guitar break? So they took it out and then re-released it. It spent 10 consecutive days at number one on TRL until it was retired. The music video itself won a Grammy, and it was the eighth most infringed song in 99, which means it was illegally downloaded a whole bunch. So the music video also, won a bunch of MTV Music Video Awards, and this was also sort of, like, the beginning of Jonathan Davies sort of, like, doing, like, gender-bendy shit with, like, his kilt and, like, wearing nail polish and doing eye makeup, and he was really out, one of, like, the first artists I remember, but that wasn't, like, Madonna or something, but, like, an alternative artist who was very supportive of, like, the gay community. He's like, it's not weird to be gay, and I can be a dude and be a straight dude or a gay dude or whatever and paint my nails, and it doesn't fucking matter. And I remember that really kind of resonating with me, and that's kind of why I was a little bit of a Korn freak. This also, the same best friend we also had discussed at length in the seventh grade about getting Korn tattoos, matching ones when we got older. We ended up getting we have matching tattoos now, but it's not of Korn. Although I wouldn't put it past her for getting a Korn tattoo at some point in the near future. What's your next pick?
So mine is a Britpop classic, Coffee and TV by Blur. I've always loved Blur because I'm a big Britpop person. I really think this song is pretty important just because it's kind of like the bookend to the reign of Britpop, which was a much bigger thing in the UK, obviously, than it was in the US. I think it was, you know, it made its mark here, like with Oasis and Blur, but I don't think it was to the same extent as it was, obviously, in the UK and in other countries for that matter.
Other European countries.
Other European countries, probably Australia and, like, just other places. But this song is, like, really kind of the bookend to that golden age of Britpop. It's also the song that's playing when Sarah Michelle Gellar and Selma Blair make out in Cruel Intentions.
Oh, yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I was surprised I had two songs that on my list that were
from Cruel Intentions.
And Colorblind is on that whole list. If you look at the 99 songs, like, Colorblind by Counting Crows is on it. I think there were a couple others from that Cruel Intentions soundtrack, but that's another reason why it's pretty iconic. The song is sung actually by Graham Coxon, who is the band's guitarist, versus Damon Albarn, who is the lead singer of Blur, or was, and also is, of course, the singer in the Gorillaz, as many of you know. It talks about Coxon's struggle with alcoholism, and coffee and TV was kind of his refuge. The song and the album itself, 13, were produced by William Orbit. William Orbit, of course, a known name in the mid to late 90s and early 2000s, because basically is responsible for all of Madonna's career from like 96 to about 2005. He produced Ray of Light, he produced Music, he produced Beautiful Stranger, the song that's on this 99 songs list as well. He also went on to produce the Charlie's Angels soundtrack.
Oh,
Mick
wow.
G connection right there.
God damn it.
And was a producer.
He's inescapable at this point.
He really is. And was a producer on Ricky Martin's self-titled album, which is on Livin' La Vida Loca's on this list, and No Doubt's Rocksteady, which comes out a few years later. The music video was directed by Hammer and Tongs, who also directed Fatboy Slim's music video for Right Here, Right Now, and Beck's music video for Hell Yes. And the music video, if any of you have ever seen it, is a very strange little music video. It has a sentient CGI milk carton character named
Milky.
Oh,
right, yeah.
And he has a picture of a missing person who is, in fact, the guitarist Graham Coxon on there. And he's on a quest to, like, go through the streets of London to try to find Graham Coxon and bring him back home to where his parents live. And that is kind of most of what I have to say about Coffee and TV, because it wasn't a big hit in the U.S., really. It was a much bigger hit in the U.K., but I really like the song. This might be the shortest description I have, but to save time, I'm okay with that.
I am also about to dive into something that has a very short description. It's Astro by White Stripes, another band that I have a great affection for, which is mm-hmm. why I wanted to talk about it, because this song is not popular or didn't chart by any means. It's a part of their beginning, which I think is why it's so significant. This song really was the beginning of it all, and it's not necessarily what turned people into White Stripes fans. It Fell in Love with a Girl is definitely what did that, mm-hmm. but this is definitely a song where you could see where they were headed. I think that it's more of like a declarative statement of what the White Stripes are going to give you as a band going forward. It was sort of the beginning of their, well, it wasn't sort of, it was the beginning of their red and white outfits. They're like DIY, Detroit garage fuzz rock sound, and the speculation of, are they brother and sister? When in reality, they were just formally married instead.
Yeah.
Turns out it was the latter. If you want to watch a really good documentary that kind of delves into their relationship around that time, Under Great White Northern Lights is a wonderful way to get to know, see, like, what their relationship was like, or hear about what their relationship was like in the beginning and how it fell apart and why the White Stripes aren't together now anymore. And you really get a good look at Meg's anxiety, which eventually drove the band to break up, which is really unfortunate. But to me, this is, for me personally, this song is really significant because it marks that I have been listening to Jack White music since, for 20 years now. I just saw the Rack and Tours on Wednesday. I've seen every single one of his bands at least once, and he still continues to put out really good rock music and has a record label. It's crazy to think that this is the beginning. You would never have guessed that that's where it would have ended up.
Yeah, and that, like, this would be the man that would eventually produce most of Loretta Lynn's, like, later work, and, like,
and Margot Price.
Like, it's very interesting. I think that's what I appreciate the most out of Jack White, is just really his versatility and being able to evolve. And
every single one of his as somebody who's seen all of his bands, every single one has a very distinct and different sound. The overarching denominator, obviously, is Jack White. He has a hand in things, but I personally really like him as a drummer on Dead Weather the most. Mm-hmm. But to tie it all back to Astro, it was probably one of the first times that I saw a woman drummer, and that was really inspiring because I've always loved the drums, and she was, when she finally blew up, it was like a mainstream thing to see female drummers, and it was kind of huge.
Because literally before her, I think it's like Karen Carpenter is really
there. Was like a handful, barely.
Yeah, but not that many.
All right, Emily, take us home with our top seven.
Sure. We both did R&B classics. I chose Heartbreak Hotel by Whitney Houston featuring Faith Evans and Kelly Price. Okay, so I had no idea about this, but apparently this song was originally intended to be on TLC's album Fan Mail.
That's amazing, because my pick also was supposed to be on Fan Mail.
Really?
Yes.
Wow! That's crazy. Okay, so they said no to it, and so it went to Whitney Houston, which is sucks for TLC because it became this huge hit.
It's also a great fucking song.
It's a great song. I mean, you hear it, and this is a heartbreak.
Oh. And this music video is so amazing. So many fur coats.
Yes.
And flip-flops.
Looks are iconic. First of all, she's on a beach in Miami wearing a fur coat. Who does that? Whitney, of course. Because Whitney Houston at this point is swimming in royalties from the Bodyguard soundtrack. So God bless her for that. She's later singing on an ottoman in a hotel room wearing this fur coat and Havaiana flip-flops, which is an iconic look that really no one else, I think, could pull off except for Miss Whitney Houston.
I really need to look up some, like, Heartbreak Hotel cosplay immediately.
I will do that as well. She also wears, in this music video, one of her signature silk gowns with a matching choker.
Oh, God.
Which she frequently wore during those, so when My Love Is Your Love, which is the album that this song is on, in a lot of those music videos, I do remember her wearing that, and also a lot of her live performances, like VH1 Divas and, like, some of those other things.
This is her statement necklace era.
And it looked, as you said, perfectly, it looked like the choker necklace was attached to the gown, because they often matched. And she is wearing on the album cover a sweater dress and leather gloves because why not?
Whatever.
She's Whitney Houston.
I'm a rich bitch.
Exactly.
Or as NeNe Leakes perfectly put it, I am very rich, bitch.
Yes. I love Whitney's willingness to experiment with these style choices. I miss her very much, of course. The song was produced by the duo Soul Shock and Carlin, Danish R&B duo. That also produced, among many songs, so some Toni Braxton songs and a few Usher songs. They also produced JoJo's Leave, Get Out.
That's such a great song.
I love that song. That and Too Little, Too Late are still great songs.
Leave, get out,
leave right now. The single sold over 1.3 million copies in the U.S. alone, making it the country's third best-selling single of 1999. And this song spent 2 weeks at number 2 behind the juggernaut that was Believe by Cher. Cher, that
Holy
song came
shit.
Out in 98, but it kept a lot of songs on this list off of number 1 because it continued
into 99. Was so
crazy
successful.
Yeah.
That's fucking crazy.
But that's what I have to say about this song. I still love it. While we're watching the music video, we had a great time.
Okay, there are lots of overarching themes that connect Heartbreak Hotel to Where My Girl's At by 702. First of all, this was rejected for fan mail. This also shares a bit of, so the music video director also directed music videos for Usher, as you had mentioned.
Yes.
Heartbreak Hotel is tangentially related. But Where My Girl's At is still a certified fucking bop. Here to tell you that.
Such a great song.
The song is on a workout playlist of mine. Every time it comes, I've sang this at karaoke. Every time it comes on, you can't help but throw your one hand up.
Yep.
Can you repeat that, please? This trio is two sisters plus one. 702 is named after the Vegas area code. But something I did not know, Vegas is also where they got discovered by the comedian Sinbad when
what?
He heard them harmonize in Caesar's Palace.
What?
I know. Mm. They broke out with this single produced by Missy Elliott. It was originally meant for TLC's fan mail album, but they rejected it. And so it became 702's signature track, going gold and hitting number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100 and staying in the top 20 for 30 fucking weeks.
What?
Yes. It is some Old Town Road shit up in here. Their music video was directed apparently by a very prolific 90s music video director, Billy Woodruff. He's also directed Usher's You Make Me Wanna, Celine Dion's My Heart Will Go On, Nelly's It's Hot in Here. Honestly, so much more. Just look him up on IMDb. He has
wow.
a shitload of credits. He's also directed a couple episodes of Claws, which makes perfect sense.
I gotta watch that show.
So good. Highly recommend. Such a great fucking nighttime soap drama. It's amazing. And Niecy Nash looks and is incredible in it. It's just really funny and super strange. And Dean from Breaking Bad is a great villain turned not as villainous anymore. Everyone's great. Can't recommend Claws enough. It's a perfect summer watch. Anyway, in their music video, they wear fuzzy cowboy hats and dance and sing in industrial elevators. And now I present to you sentences that are so perfectly written on Wikipedia that I don't need to do any editorializing. For undisclosed conflicting personal reasons with the record label, Kalima Williams, who's not a sister, distanced herself from the sisters after the release of the album and was replaced by Cree Lamore, a solo singer who Irish and Lamisha, who are the Grinstead sisters, personally picked to join the group. The new lineup released a single called Pootie Tang from the movie Pootie Tang. Though shortly after this, Camila Williams returned to the group and for undisclosed reasons, Cree Lamore left the ensemble. With the return of Camila Williams, they released the album Star, which is mostly remembered for the single I Still Love You. The group then disbanded in 2006, then regrouped again in 2017, and appeared on the 2017 Soul Train Music Awards.
Wow.
Yeah. 702, I mean, this song, I couldn't believe, though, that it spent 30 weeks in the top 20. This song was also everywhere, but unlike a lot of songs that were everywhere when Steal My Sunshine, I was not sick of this song. I really love this bop. They came out around the time of, like, Destiny's Child, and them and Black, which Billy Woodruff also directed a Black music video, which is why I confused the two music videos together, because they were very similar in sort of palette theme and also just, like, general theme. They were, like, in industrial spaces, kind of, like, wearing, like, iconic, weird outfits. They were, like, vaguely futuristic. Like, that fuzzy cowboy hat had, like, a weird futuristic feel to it. Those are all of our personal picks, but we're going to run down some honorable mentions. My favorite honorable mention is Candy by Mandy Moore.
Yeah.
That music video was great. The VW Beetle, that was a really long commercial for it.
Yeah.
She also says, me and Candy, like Jenna from 30 Rock, May and Candy, which is such a fucking hallmark of the time in a way to sing for whatever reason.
I have two quick things to say. The song is still a bop. I know Mandy Moore has openly said that she hates the song and wants to refund anyone who bought a copy of her album So Real. But out of all the blonde pop star explosion, I would argue this song is in the top three of, like, the 98, 99.
It's good. It's such a good song. It's so catchy. And I think it does still hold up. I heard this song in a dance class. Shout out to Choreography at ODC Dance Center in San Francisco. He does a dance with this song. And when I heard it, I immediately started singing. It's one of those things similar to Blink-182's All the Small Things, which also has a spot on our honorable mention list.
Yeah.
When you hear, as soon as you hear the song, you remember all of the lyrics for whatever reason. You're like, oh, cool. I'm so glad that I can't remember algebra, but I know all of the words to Candy.
And the spoken interlude.
Love always, Mandy. I'm craving for you.
I'm craving.
I'm missing you like candy. Oh, yeah.
That was our harmony.
Yes. Next is Hot Boys, the remix by Missy. By the way, I also love that the ostensible hot boy is Genuine in this music video.
That's great.
He was a fucking hot boy. Okay. It was, like, the perfect time to feature him in a music video about hot boys.
That's, like, a connection to all of my homes, because Missy Elliott is from Virginia and Genuine is from D.C. So, anyway, I had to say that out loud.
My first note is that Hot Boys is the spiritual prequel to Tempo.
I know. That's what I said.
Oh, my God. No, you did.
Tempo in my thing. Yes. Which might be my favorite track on that album.
Same. Oh, well, I don't know. I like Soulmate a lot.
That is a good track.
But anyway, I don't know if I said... No, I didn't say it in the Bachelorette group that. I think I just texted it to Emily. But I was like, has anybody tried playing Soulmate by Lizzo for Hannah to see if that helps her with anything?
She won't listen to that. It's not country music.
But maybe we could try. Anyway, Hot Boys is another entry into the Missy Elliott iconic Luke's Hall of Fame. I love her, like, rhinestone motorcycle jacket, the, like, Kate Plus 8 side swoop that looks... That's the only way I can describe that haircut. No. She had it before Kate Plus 8. I will give her, obviously, the Missy Elliott side swoop. Let's just call it that. She's dancing around, also in an industrial space, sort of feels like Mad Max meets California Love, meets weird... smack my bitch up kind of vibes. I forgot that Eve has a verse on this.
Yeah.
Fucking Eve was on fire at this point because I think after this she'll guest with Gwen Stefani.
Oh, and yeah, that Let Me Blow Your Mind.
And that was like a huge hit as well.
The one thing that I have to say about this is this, in the last few years, my home state has been changing all the names to all our streets and schools because they were all named after Confederate generals and terrible people. The ultimate consolation prize, by the way. And it took us 150 years to figure that shit out. Is really problematic and bad, but I really hope that we take the time to rename some of these things after Missy Elliott, Timbaland, and Pharrell, because they are all better Virginians than garbage like Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. That
Agreed.
Is all.
And you know what? That's a perfect segue into that don't impress me much, because that do not impress a me a matcha. I don't know. This music video is probably in my mind more than the song, because of the leopard print body, well, cape, suits. Like, I just love this whole outfit. And I love the premise of Shania Twain is hitchhiking around in the desert, which the name implies that no one's around.
Yeah.
And yet all of these useless men keep trying to pick her up, and she keeps telling them that that don't impress her much.
Is that maybe the opening to Showgirls? Like, isn't that a little, like...
No. Showgirls, like, at least she's on the way to Vegas.
That's true.
Yes.
That's true.
I love Showgirls because she immediately pukes out of anger in, like, the first 5 minutes.
Yes. Some acting in that movie.
I don't really have much else to say other than this is a good song. Haim does a really great cover of it.
Yeah. I have just, like, 2 notes.
Oh, and Shania Twain, maybe she doesn't quite hold up as well now as a person in light of, like, some Trumpy-ish comments that I don't really... I didn't want to look it back up because I didn't want to be in a bad mood. But she was a guest judge on RuPaul's Drag Race this season, and she made some Don't Impress Me Much jokes. So let's just leave it there.
Quick things I will say, though, is I almost included Goodbye Earl by the Dixie Chicks in my list because 1999 and, like, the late 90s in general were great years for women in country. This is before, like, today's country radio, which is basically all white dudes with guitars talking about being in pickup trucks and having nice honeys with a cold beer in their hand. I love this song. I love that it is a part. This is the tamer end of the, like, I don't care very much for these guys songs. Like, Goodbye Earl is like the, this man did me wrong and now I'm going to kill him type of country song.
Right.
The other thing is that this song had a country version and a pop version, which wasn't something that people did all the time, but Shania was kind of a pioneer for the country crossover world. And she did a lot of those kinds of things on the Come On Over album. And this is something that Taylor Swift later on would do in her beginning of her career when she was still pretty much a country star. That's what I have to say.
Well, there is no smooth segue for this one. Because it's ODB's Got Your Money.
Yep.
I think this is notable. I mean, first of all, this song is a classic song. Everybody likes this song. This was after Fantasy, so ODB was, like, very much in the mainstream. He was also on his way out in more ways than one, RIP ODB. Mm-hmm. But this song is very, very remarkable because it features Khalees and the Neptunes and while they were on their come up. So it's probably one of, like, their biggest hits, but they were fairly anonymous in the process because ODB, although he wasn't the biggest man, overshadowed everything.
Yep.
And his association to Wu-Tang as well.
I think I just have a personal thing. If there were an Emily at School Dances, a retrospect playlist, this would certainly be up there with Casey and JoJo's All My Life and Missy Elliott's Get Your Freak On and Pharrell's Beautiful. Definitely remember this song is one of the first songs I dabbled in, like, quote-unquote dirty dancing at a school dance.
Freak dance.
Freak dancing, which just meant grinding on a dude. I had no rhythm, but it didn't matter. This was just, like, there.
Yeah, I wouldn't even argue that maybe this isn't, like, a super danceable song.
No, it's not.
I definitely tried to do some choreography to it. It's not the easiest thing. The number one of the Rolling Stones, 99 and 99, is rightfully TLC's No Scrubs.
Yep.
This song is still prevalent and relevant today. It is produced by Candy Burris, so she makes tons of fucking money off of the song. It was, like, sampled in that Ed Sheeran song recently. And who doesn't know the words, again, just as muscle reflex? You're just like, yep, no, I don't want no scrubs.
Yep.
Scrub is a guy that can't get no love from me. Duh. It was an anthem from 99 and beyond. And it was a perfect way to relaunch TLC into the pop culture lexicon permanently this time with No Scrubs. And Left Eye's rap is great. And it's on the extended version. May She Rest.
No Scrubs was the second biggest Hot 100 single of 1999 in the U.S., only behind, ding, 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 Cher's Believe.
Holy fuck, Cher.
I know. And the music video, of course, I don't know if you said this, was directed by Hype Williams.
Oh, I didn't say this.
Yes. So another Hype Williams directed music video. I still, of course, speaking of Candy, stan, of course, the song Don't Think I'm Not. I also didn't realize she had co-written Bills, Bills, Bills and Pink's There You Go.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah.
Way to go,
Candy. Cha-cha-cha-ching.
After Escape, she had a very lucrative songwriting career, so good for her.
And she's won multiple Grammys. I mean, Candy's a fucking legend. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she's great in Real Housewives of Atlanta. Anyway, somebody once told me that this song was really fucking corny.
Hate on this song as much you want, but
it's catchy. The video is still funny.
It's like a cat. It has 9 lives thanks to internet culture in the movie Shrek.
Yeah, that's true. It continues to live on. I don't know how much Smash Mouth is still getting paid from it. I mean, definitely from, like, the Shrek soundtrack and all of that. But, I mean, as you said, first of all, it's crazy that this song was actually associated with the movie Mystery Men, which didn't do very well. No. I saw it in theaters. I really liked it. I think it has cult classic
I think you're right.
status now, but was not well received at the time. And I, nope. Mystery Men was essentially like the first spoof satire. Well, I mean, it was more of like a satire because it was really well written and it had like Ben Stiller and a bunch of other actors, Pee Wee Herman out of Pee Wee Herman drag for the first time.
Right.
Anyway, it was a spoof satire on superheroes before superheroes were even a trend.
Directed by Mick G.
The music video, not Mystery Men.
Yeah, no. It features, at the beginning, Dane Cook in the superhero audition scene as Waffle Iron Man. And this is before Dane Cook was, like, king of the bros in the mid-2000s.
He was also in Mystery Men.
I've never seen it, by the way. I probably should see it. The one thing to note is because it's had 9 lives as a song, Devotion, as Wikipedia says, quote, Devotion towards the song has been considered a factor in the intense interest towards the series and titular character in Shrek observed on the internet, and in turn has been noted as a popular internet meme. And this has has resulted in the Smash Mouth Twitter account, whoever is running it, I hope it is lead singer Steve Harwell, who's basically brunette Guy Fieri. he gets into online fights with internet trolls. So for years, they respond to people who tweet about it being, quote, that Shrek song with, actually, that song was number one on the charts years before Shrek came out. And I love that not only does he look exactly like Guy Fieri, they are actually best friends in real life. And so if it's possible that the two humans on the planet...
They should dress as each other for Halloween.
They are the two humans on the planet that have kept gel tips alive since 1999.
And also pencil-thin facial hair.
Like a neck... What would you even call that?
Like it was a neck pencil mark. Yeah. I don't even know. And just the... pencil thin goatee. It was like rockabilly, but make it grosser.
Like I have to think they're like Steve Harwell has a stencil. Like that's how
laughed as hard as I have. Well, actually, it was a couple days ago, but I laughed so hard at that part where he jumps up on the car in the music video because he is not graceful. So no. I don't believe for one second he did that stunt himself. That bitch is not fucking Tom Cruise.
No.
But the song is undeniably catchy, and sometimes if I want to fuck with somebody, I will write some of the lyrics in their birthday card. Anyway, from All Stars to All the Small Things by Blink-182, this is our last honorable mention.
Yeah.
Mostly because I want to talk about how Enemy of the State is turning 20, another album that I put on, and I still know all the words front to back, every single fucking song. Yes. And that's really, I don't know if that's a good thing or like a weird talent or if, I don't know, I should just go to the doctor and get that checked out.
It's amazing how much I knew it by heart and yet didn't know what half the things meant. And
none.
Yeah.
I don't know if
sodomy. We were talking about that the other time.
I
was like,
I tell the story on the podcast?
Yeah. And even the word enema, I didn't know what that was for many years.
Right. I think I saw it on like the side of like a box in a Walgreens or some shit. And I was like, oh. Got it.
I have a sweet story to tell about the filming of this music video. Mark Hoppus, the lead singer, met his future wife, Skye Everly, on the set. She was an executive at MTV. Tom would like prank him and try to ask people out on his behalf. And so he asked her out, and at first she said no. But later they dated and went on to get married. And I think they are still married to this day.
Aww.
Yeah.
Blink-182 is still a band to this day, but they're just not as good.
Nope. This music video retired after 65 days on the countdown on TRL. And parodies, I think it's Britney Spears, the music video for Sometimes, NSYNC, Tearing Up My Heart, Christina Aguilera, I don't remember which album or which
Genie in a Bottle.
It is Genie in a Bottle. Yeah, you're right. And then one of the 98 Degrees songs.
Whenever they're, like, wearing all white and getting doused. I mean, I loved this music video. Yeah. It was so funny. This is truly Lonely Island before Lonely Island.
Actually, Boys, I Want It That Way. Yeah.
It parodies all of them so perfectly.
Yep.
And as somebody that was like, yeah, I don't like boy bands, even though I still secretly did, I was like, yeah, this music video is great because it's, like, making fun because they're, like, corny.
LOL.
Lulz. Mm. Man. Enemy of the State. Can't believe it's turning 20. Yep. What a great album.
Great album.
Oh, gosh, that's a lot of music. We have been talking about a lot of music for a long time now. And that about wraps up the Rolling Stone 99 of 99, our personal picks. We talked about music videos. We talked about 99 in general. And now we will also talk about where you can find us on the social meds. You can follow this podcast at The Old Millennials Pod on Instagram. And we are individually on Twitter.
You can follow me at Emily A. Vision.
And me at Margs Shiro. We're also going to be putting together a Spotify playlist that our 99 picks. Well, they're not even 99 picks on there. But it's going to be all of the songs that we discussed from this episode are all going to be on a Spotify playlist. We will link to it within the show notes. So we hope you enjoy. And also, if you enjoy this podcast, it'd be really cool if you could rate us and leave a nice review and just subscribe. Yep. So until next time, we bid you a goodbye.
Bye.